This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 150 years ago, in April 1865, the American Civil War ended. That milestone in American history was accompanied by a Charlotte historical milestone. Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, fleeing the Union troops who captured Richmond, held the last meeting of his cabinet here in our city. There's this little plaque on Tryon Street that talks all about that. Like Abraham Lincoln, Davis was born in Kentucky. He served in the United States Army, later became Secretary of War under President Franklin Pierce, and went on to become a U.S. Senator. Now, it may surprise you to discover that Davis argued against secession, though he did believe that each state was sovereign and had an unquestionable right to secede from the Union. When the South broke away, he became the first and only president of the Confederate States of America. After his capture in 1865, he was accused of treason but was not tried and was released after 2 years. Now, for those who still give the matter thought, Davis is viewed as either a traitor or a patriot, and we'll be looking into that today with both an historian and the great-great-grandson of Jefferson Davis. Bertram Hayes Davis is working to rehabilitate his relative's name and help people understand his motivations and his legacy. He joins us in advance of a program tonight at the Levine Museum of the New South at 7:30, information about which we have on our website at WFAE.org. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Dr. David Goldfield is also with us. He is the Robert Lee Bailey Professor of History at UNC Charlotte and the author of numerous award-winning books, including America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation. Thanks for coming back. Appreciate it.
Great to be here, Mike. Thank you.
I feel like, I swear to God, I feel like I'm in the presence of history. Do you get that a lot?
We do. We've been traveling for 35 years and educating ourselves about Jefferson Davis as much as we can, as I represent the family. But everywhere I go, people look at it and are amazed. First of all, that there is a descendant. Second of all, I still have the name, even though it's hyphenated, which is another peculiar story. But the third is that why are you doing that? And it's, as you said, the legacy of Jefferson Davis is misrepresented by that one sentence in a history book: elected president of the Confederate States of America. And all kinds of things go along with that that people assume, whereas the first 52 years of his life essentially doesn't exist. So we're working on that.
I guess it's because of the unique part of American history that I feel this, because I've had the great-great-grandson of Charles Dickens on this program too, and I didn't feel quite the same way talking to him, although it was a nice conversation. You are also a President Davis. You have served since 1976 as the president of the Davis Family Association, since 1988 as the president of the Papers of Jefferson Davis. Well, I don't know why papers need a president. You've also been the president of the Beauvoir Foundation, the last home of Jefferson Davis. And I know that in your real life, you've worked for years in the oil and gas exploration industry, but clearly, this is your passion. Do you think that most Americans do, in fact, misunderstand Jefferson Davis, or are they all in the North?
Well, that's an interesting question. As we started, of course, most of our initial talks and conversations were with Southern people about Southern things and Jefferson Davis. But as we expanded the topic to become part of America nationally, we just interviewed with the History Channel. I think tonight is actually the Civil War in Color. And they interviewed me for 2.5 hours, and I hope I'm more than 30 seconds on the cutting floor. But what we've seen is that as we bring the facts to people's attention about everything that we're trying to educate America, suddenly the understanding that there's more to the man than meets the eye is important. So,
what's your take on that, Dr. Goldfield? Is what do most Americans think? What do history teachers say about Jefferson Davis?
Most Americans are pretty indifferent toward Jefferson Davis, particularly in the North, and even in the South, as a result of all this immigration we've had over the past 30 years. Jefferson Davis becomes sort of a hazy figure. You won't find that many people who have really strong opinions one way or the other, but those strong opinions are held most likely in the South.
Mm. You have a hyphenated name. You mentioned it. It's Bertram Hayes Davis. And I read that you came to that name through an act of the Mississippi legislature. Talk about that.
Well, it was an act of legislature that changed my grandfather's name, but there's a little more to the story. When Davis died in December of 1889 in New Orleans, the entire Hayes family gathered, as only one daughter had been married with children. All the boys had died, so there's no namesake to continue. And in a hotel that room that day, the Verena Davis looked over across the street and said, "There lies the last Davis. Isn't it a shame we can't do something about that?" And in that hotel room that day, they looked at my grandfather, whose name was Jefferson Addison Hayes Davis, Hayes, and asked him to change his name.
What year was that?
That was 1889, December.
That was probably, could that have been the first hyphenated name? I mean, it's commonplace now because women don't necessarily take their husband's last name, so it's common now. It wasn't common then. Could it have been the first, you think?
Well, I'm certain that it was one of the earlier ones, and it was indicative because he had to carry that piece of legislature, which was about 2x1, around with him because it was his birth certificate.
Yeah. So if your wife, I take it she's taken your last name.
Yes, she has.
But had she not, it would have been a triple hyphenated name.
Not allowed. And, you know, hyphenation is one of those punctuation points that's being severely missed.
Jefferson Davis's wife, Verena, left Richmond on March 31st, 1865. That was just days before the capital of the Confederacy fell to Union forces. She came to Charlotte. Why?
It's interesting that they had conversations about it, and Davis was unclear about where he was going to go or when he was going to go. But he did have that personification to know that his family was important. Now, not only Verena, but five kids along with him.
Right.
There were four of his and one adopted African-American, James Limbaugh. So they traveled.
No, wait, stop right there. I never knew that. They adopted an African-American?
They adopted an African-American in Richmond. His name was Jim Limbaugh.
Was he a member of the family, or did he work as a slave?
He was on the streets of Richmond. Mm-hmm. Unclear if he was free or if he was a son of a slave. But Verena adopted him in about 1863, and he was part of the family. He grew up in the White House, and he traveled with
him. The Southern White House.
The Southern White House. That's correct. And so they traveled, and I think Davis said, he always said, "Well, you have to go south." He wasn't sure what. There's correspondence that says something about meeting me in Washington, Georgia, Abbeville, Georgia. Those are names that are mentioned, and they were going that way. But he didn't probably realize that he was going to become a fugitive rather than just to escape.
I want to step back to this adopted child. I think it's fascinating because he's been accused, Jefferson Davis has been accused of being a racist.
Yes.
And he certainly was the president of the Confederacy, and the Confederacy, and we'll talk about this, every state that wrote an article of secession. I don't care what people say that it wasn't about slavery. Every state that wrote an article of secession pointed to slavery as the primary reason, the perpetuation of slavery as the primary reason they needed to secede. So the war was about slavery. Why would he let his wife adopt this child?
Well, it wasn't a question of why. Verena did what Verena thought was the right thing to do, and she never did shy away from that. But one of the most misunderstood thing is that Davis was always quoted as having his free Negroes on his plantation. He had a plan for the integration of the slave population into American public. His plantation had education, had management, had religion, had laws, and had self-governance. And he knew that that educational process would be necessary for that integration of slavery.
Did you know this? Was this common
yes,
knowledge?
Yes, and in fact, his brother Joseph Davis had an even more model plantation.
I'm baffled by this. This is completely new news. Was it common knowledge at the time?
It was common knowledge. Matter of fact, a lot of the larger slaveholders were against him because they called him free Negroes, and they didn't want that. And Davis said, "This is the message that we need to do. This is what's going to perpetuate your industry."
Well, how did a man who practiced what he preached about this become the president of the Confederacy?
Not by his choice. Always remember that Davis didn't want to be anything other than what it is that he thought he should be, which is a military leader. When he got to telegram at Briarfield, when he was expected not to do anything, he turned ashen and looked to his wife, and his wife said, "You know, this is the worst news that he could ever have." He never wanted it,
right,
this position. And remember, it was an appointment more than an election. The election didn't happen until November that year, so he was appointed.
So Verena left Richmond in 1865, March 31st. Richmond fell to the Union shortly thereafter. Jefferson Davis arrived here in Charlotte on April the 19th, set up his presidential office on Tryon Street, and there's a plaque on Tryon. Have you seen it yet? Have you been there yet?
Not yet. I'm going to see that today.
There's a plaque on Tryon Street that says this is where he stood when he heard the news of President Lincoln's assassination. He held regular meetings in that office on Tryon Street until April the 26th of 1865, he and his cabinet. What were they meeting about? It was over.
Well, it wasn't, in reference to the government still in force. And remember that Davis has this stoic personality. He's one that doesn't ever back down from a responsibility. And he's still president of the Confederate States of America, and that's how he looked at it. That's how he portrayed it to the people that were still with him. Now, he had lost several cabinet members by this point in time, but he was never one to say, I'm not going to be the one to say it's over. Mm-hmm. It's not my decision.
Did they know, and I'll ask you this too, Dr. Goldfield, did they know that if they lost, that they would be in serious trouble with the United States military and the United States government, that they would be outlaws?
What's interesting is that before Lincoln's death, he was on the impression, and I think everyone was, that when Lincoln was going to just let them up easy, he wanted Davis to escape. We should be English, for instance, I think. But we aren't, because this is the point where everything changed for Davis. He becomes just an escaping government to try to quietly leave to the most wanted fugitive in the United States, wanted for the assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, Lincoln, everything I've read, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the Civil War expert here, Dr. Goldfield, but it was his intention to be lenient on the South. In fact, when the South fell, he had Dixie played on the White House lawn by a military band. Is that in fact true? Would he have been lenient had he lived?
Absolutely true. Abraham Lincoln said to one of his colleagues, would be good if, to the effect that it would be good if Jefferson Davis disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really
He didn't mean CIA disappeared.
No. just go away. He didn't really want to deal with it. Lincoln's number one objective was to restore the Union.
Mrs. Davis left Charlotte shortly after she got here because there was a rumor of an impending attack on Charlotte. Still, her husband came, but she got on board the money train. She got on board the train that was traveling from Richmond with the treasury of the Confederacy to Chester. She took the train from Charlotte to Chester and got off there, and then I think went on to Abbeville in South Carolina for a while. What happened to the money on that train? Does anybody know what happened to the Confederate treasury?
Oh, I wish I knew, Mike. There were several rumors that there were two rumors. One rumor that it was buried somewhere between here and Rock Hill, and everybody who digs a swimming pool between here and Rock Hill hopes to find the treasury. Another rumor surfaced that Judah P. Benjamin, who was at one time the Secretary of War, then Secretary of State, took the treasury and took some of it to escape to England because he was also implicated in the assassination of Lincoln.
When we come back, we're going to talk more about Jefferson Davis with his great-great-grandson, Bertram Hayes Davis, and with Dr. David Goldfield, professor of history at UNC Charlotte. And we'll talk about the motivations for the Civil War and the legacy of Jefferson Davis as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Signature Healthcare Concierge Medicine, with offices in Uptown and South Park, providing patients with 24/7 physician access, personalized executive healthcare, and same-day appointments. 704-554-8787. Well, we all know about America's obesity epidemic. We know about the rising incidences of asthma and diabetes. In fact, diabetes affecting younger and younger people. And, of course, heart disease has always been a concern. We've been blaming diet and food on all of this. Perhaps lack of exercise plays more of a role in this, and perhaps that is due to how we have built America since World War II. At least that is the theory of Dr. Richard Jackson, who joins us to tell us more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, about 45 million Americans go to their doctors for a physical at least once a year. But some researchers have begun to question the value of these routine exams, the pros and cons of an annual physical.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We sit here just about 150 years to the day of the end of the American Civil War with the great-great-grandson of the President of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis. Bertram Hayes Davis is with us this morning, along with Dr. David Goldfield from UNC Charlotte, the author of America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation. And there's another book that you wrote about the Civil War whose name is escaping me at the moment.
Still Fighting the Civil War.
And I guess in many ways we are. That's why we're having
this conversation. I hope so. It helps book sales.
Off the air a second ago, you were talking about the impact that the attitude that Jefferson Davis and his brother had about slaves, the fact that they had free black men and women on their plantations, the fact that they had education for them, religious activities for them. And the reason they did this, you were saying, was because they knew that they were outnumbered, the white folks in the South were outnumbered by the slaves. And if they uprose or were set free with no plan, there would be anarchy. But the end result of their working with the people that they associated with was that when the South became the New South, when slavery went away, several of the people that they worked carefully with, of the free African Americans they worked carefully with, became very successful in, of all places, Mississippi. Talk about that.
I think it's exactly what you just said, is that I don't know if it was the fear of anarchy or that uprising. What it was is that they realized that slavery would come to an end, that institution could not continue the way that it was, and we had to integrate that society of African Americans into the American society, and the only way to do that is through a process.
Abraham Lincoln, I think largely because of the Emancipation Proclamation and because of what happened at the end of the war, the fact that the North won and slavery ended, gets a lot of credit, particularly among African Americans, for being their messiah, essentially, for setting them free. And yet he was on the fence for a good deal of his life about what to do with these folks. At one point, David, did he not have a plan or agree with a plan to send them back to Africa?
That's correct. He was, if not a member, certainly a supporter of the American Colonization Society, whose objective was to literally deport 4 million freed slaves back to Africa.
So here you have this maligned president of the Confederacy who has taken a more enlightened attitude than the president of the Union, who gets all the credit.
I think... to correct that a little bit, we can say Lincoln's views on slavery evolved over time. And by the time of the Emancipation Proclamation, he certainly believed that slavery...
Well, did he, or was that a weapon? Was that a weapon to use against
the South?
It
was both. It was both. It was both a military strategy, and it was something that he felt deeply moral about.
Mm-hmm. But that's why that's one of the missions that you're on, because this is – I didn't know this. I don't think anybody knows this about Jefferson Davis and his brother Joseph. What you're saying is that these were not bad guys.
Well, I hope not. I mean, I wouldn't be sitting here calling them bad guys, even if they were probably as a descendant. But I think the realization is that everybody assumes that Davis was the leader of this society of cruelty and whatever. And up until the last moment that he left the Senate of the United States, as you said, he was against everything that he was about to lead. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the responsibility came. And he did talk about slavery in reference to that institution.
So we're still arguing, as his book title would indicate, about the Civil War in this country, because it's fascinating. In fact, USA Today reports that two out of every three Americans have an ancestor who lived through the Civil War, which is probably, and most of them probably live on the East Coast, but that's probably why we still talk about it, because it still resonates with us. And one of the arguments is, and I've heard this from the sons of the Confederate veterans, that the war was not about slavery. It was about states' rights. What did Jefferson Davis think the war was about?
Well, you have to realize that Davis had been in Washington for 10 years prior to the war and had taken an active role in much of the legislation and much of the discussion. So even though slavery was an issue, it was also an economic issue. There were taxation issues. There was states' rights issues. There was control issues, federal government versus states' government. Very complicated period of history, I think you would agree.
Yeah, definitely. States' rights was certainly prominent, but the question is what state right was most important to Southerners, and that was the preservation and particularly the extension of slavery.
So what was the war about?
If you didn't have slavery, if slavery did not exist, there would have been no Civil War.
What do you think the war was
about? I think
he's
right. I think that that was the issue. I think that the end result of the war, however, to unify the country back, was the beginning of the of Lincoln's, we're going to get the country unified back. At the point of the Emancipation Proclamation, it became a moral war. Mm. I mean, that's where I think it shifts dramatically. And I think that the economic pressures on the South were definitely tied to slavery.
Now, the war also decided a major thing. The war decided federal rights supersede state rights, states' rights, especially when it comes to secession. You can't leave. You're here for the long haul. That was an open debate back then, was it not? Was it the war that decided that, or was there something constitutional that the South was ignoring?
The war decided that secession is unconstitutional. Regardless of what Rick Perry says in Texas, states cannot secede. But the war did not decide the relationship between the federal government and the states. We're still arguing about that
right.
Today.
Exactly. Wikipedia says, and you have to take what Wikipedia says with a grain of salt, but they say about Jefferson Davis, many historians attribute the Confederacy's weaknesses to the leadership of President Davis, his preoccupation with detail, reluctance to delegate responsibility, lack of popular appeal, feuds with powerful state governors, favoritism toward old friends, inability to get along with people who disagreed with him, neglect of civil matters in favor of military ones, and resistance to public opinion all worked against him. Do you agree with any of that? And either of you?
No.
Okay.
I mean, look at this, Mike. First of all, if you are going to select a president of a new country, the Confederacy, there were few people who had better resumes than Jefferson Davis, a war hero with the Mexican War, long experience in government, in the cabinet, and as a United States senator. And also, he had the opportunity to draw these two extreme factions together, that is, the fire eaters on one side and the folks that were very, very reluctant to secede on the other. And he was sort of in the middle. So in that sense, he was an obvious choice for president. But what you have to realize, the task that he confronted was almost impossible. How do you create and sustain a new nation at the same time you are fighting a bloody civil war on your own territory?
And trying to build armies and keep the economy going.
Exactly.
And create foreign relationships that might have helped you keep the South going.
Now, he did have some character flaws, and Verena Howell Davis would agree to some of these flaws. And one of the flaws was, one, he didn't really have a sense of humor, and I think a leader has to have a sense of humor. But secondly, he was fairly rigid in his viewpoints. I mentioned earlier that Lincoln evolved. That's difficult to say about Jefferson Davis.
Would you agree with that? You're a relative.
I absolutely do agree with that. It was his way or the highway. I mean, he was very focused and straight ahead on anything that he did, and he proved that. And it did cause a lot of consternation in reference to the leadership. I mean, but without that, we probably wouldn't have succeeded to last for 4 years. They needed that strength, and though it did cause a lot of anger.
You are the president of the papers of Jefferson Davis, which I guess means you are the keeper of the papers of Jefferson Davis. And back that was back when people wrote letters and kept their letters and other kinds of correspondence as well. What do you, as a family member, know, either through those papers, which I'm sure you have ingested several times over, or just anecdotal stories that have been passed down from generation to generation in the Davis family? What do you know about him and how he conducted himself in that period of his life?
I think what's fascinating is that even though that Davis didn't evolve during his presidency, he did evolve in his life. And so he had a lot of tragedies that evolved. He married Zachary Taylor's daughter, mm-hmm, against Zachary Taylor's wishes. 3 months later, she was dead, died of yellow fever in Mississippi. And Zachary Taylor obviously was distraught that his daughter that. So he goes into this period of 8 years, and all he does is plant and study. He doesn't have any contact with anybody except his brother and his plantation. But as he evolves out of that, suddenly he reconciles with Zachary Taylor, becomes their friends. He becomes engaged in politics. Then he becomes engaged in the military. Then he becomes engaged in the cabinet and into the Senate. So he evolves to this leadership role, whereas in 1835, when he married, the only thing he was going to probably do is move to Mississippi and be a planter.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I see, is all these things that happened, all these intersections of Davis in his life that got him to 1861. And people don't understand the power that he had in reference to Pierce or Zachary Taylor. He was used to talking to presidents. He didn't talk to freshman senators.
What was life like for him after the war, after he got out of prison? What was life like for him for the rest of his life?
It was very interesting. He searched for an identity, really. I think he didn't know where he was going to be. He didn't have citizenship, so he didn't have a lot of those qualities.
They took his citizenship away?
He was the last one to get a citizenship back in 1976.
Really?
1976.
It didn't do him much good then, did it?
No, I don't think so. However, he did evolve. He went to England a lot. He traveled around the country. He ended up in Memphis. He went to work for a company, sold insurance, that went bankrupt. And in 1878, he actually was bequeathed the opportunity to come to Biloxi and Beauvoir by Sarah Dorsey to write his memoirs. And that's what he always wanted to do. So he did that from 78 to 80. Sarah Dorsey dies. He buys Beauvoir from him, and that was his last years. He traveled immensely for the first half of the—
Where did the money come from for all of that?
Well, you know, Davis had Briarfield. He did have a plantation. He did have money. So he
had a Confederate treasury, didn't he?
Well, I wish that was the case. I probably wouldn't be sitting here today if that was true. We always wonder about that. But there were. I mean, he did work at Carolina. He did have investments. So he wasn't destitute. Right. But he wasn't anything. I mean, when he was in Briarfield in the 1850s, he's probably one of the richest people in Mississippi. His brother definitely was maybe the wealthiest person in Mississippi.
There's a great we're having a great debate in this country today about Edward Snowden, who is the employee, I guess, of the National Security Agency, who released a lot of papers and information about how they conduct their business to the New York Times and other operations around the world, and is now living in Russia in exile. We are talking about whether or not what he did was a patriotic move, because he was trying to show the public that we're operating in secret in the government and that we are doing things in the American people's names that perhaps the American people would not be approving of. So some people say he's a traitor. Some people say he's a patriot. Was Jefferson Davis a traitor, or was he a patriot, Dr. Goldfield?
I'd say he was neither. I would prefer to look upon it as being misguided, perhaps, but certainly not a traitor. His idea was to not invade or destroy the United States. He felt that the United States had really left him, not the other way around.
Can you be successful in a war where both the president of the country fighting the war against the other side and the lead general, Robert E. Lee, come to their jobs with a certain amount of reluctance? because they were both Americans, United States American citizens. They were both in the U.S. Army. They had to go and fight for their homeland, the land of their birth, over the land of their land of their birth being Virginia, and in this case Mississippi. Can you win if that's your attitude?
I think reluctance was a great attribute for both General Lee and Jefferson Davis, because they obviously thought about this for quite some time before making that commitment. And if you're a zealot about it, it means you probably have not thought through all the consequences and all of the aspects that you need to.
In advance of secession, we had reached an impasse on a key issue, slavery, in the United States Congress and clearly throughout the country. Leaders in the South decided that compromise was simply impossible. They feared westward expansion of the country with the exclusion of slavery in the new territories would bring an end to slavery in their area. You have written that pre-Civil War America was a nation enmeshed in fears. You also say that the evangelical wing of the Republican Party of the time drove a wedge between Americans. What year are we talking about? 1861 or 2015?
Well, we're talking mainly about the mid-1850s. The Republican Party was an amalgam of many different political groups, including a party called the Know-Nothings, which was established yes. in 1853. They were formerly called the American Party, but the nickname was the Know-Nothings. And this party had many evangelical Protestants who were opposed to immigration, particularly immigration of Roman Catholics. They were basically an anti-Catholic party. It was the first time in our history that a political party was formed on basis of religious bigotry. And these folks were part of the Republican Party base. Abraham Lincoln was not a religious bigot, but many in his party were. And eventually the evangelicals used the slavery issue not as a political issue, but elevated into a moral cause, so that if you opposed them, you were not merely misinformed or misguided, you were sinful. And how do you compromise with sin?
I'm going to ask you again, what year are we talking about? 1859 or 2015?
Well, I'll let you and the listeners draw the connections between then and 2015.
But there are parallels, aren't there?
There certainly are parallels.
Does it strike you as odd, or is it something that's simply cyclical in the American psyche that we keep rolling around to these factions?
I keep telling my students that it's important to know history, otherwise we repeat it. And we tend to repeat it because we don't know history.
Hmm. Are there lessons to be learned if we just look back? I mean, will we change our attitude? Will we change our behavior today?
Certainly. I really wish we would adhere to the Constitution, particularly the First Amendment, which establishes the strict separation of church and state. Thomas Jefferson said that his view of it was that there was a wall of separation between church and state, and I really wish that we would maintain that wall.
Dr. David Goldfield is a professor of history and author of America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation. And we're also here with the great-great-grandson of Jefferson Davis, Bertram Hayes Davis, and we'll talk more about what he knows. He's already blown my mind about what he knows about the former president of the Confederacy that we should know to repatriate his name. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Ballet's Contemporary Fusion. Three unique ballets merge into one performance with music from Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring to a live DJ April 23rd through 25th at Knight Theater. Tickets at charlotteballet.org. About 45 million Americans go to their doctors for a physical at least once a year, but some researchers have begun to question the value of these routine exams. The pros and cons of an annual physical coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you would like to talk about Jefferson Davis, about the Confederacy, about anything we've been discussing this hour, now's your shot at us. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, and we're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it. the expectation is sanctions are going to be removed rather quickly, and that would impact the life of many people.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
According to the January count, more than 85% of chronically homeless people in Charlotte have mental health problems.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Bertram Hayes Davis, our guest, the great-great-grandson of Jefferson Davis, the first and only president of the Confederacy who held the last cabinet meeting of the Confederacy here in Charlotte. Dr. David Goldfield, professor of history at UNC Charlotte, also with us. Tonight, they're both doing a presentation at 7:30 at the Levine Museum of the New South, commemorating the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the New South. And you have to register online in advance for that because seating is limited. Information on our website at WFAE.org. The New South. It's a term that came later, much later than the Civil War. And some people have said that the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War was the beginning of the New South. That's not really true, is it?
No. But Henry Grady, an Atlanta newspaper man, was also a great promoter of the South. And, of course, Atlanta was fairly destroyed during the Civil War.
They've never recovered, have they?
No, certainly not compared with Charlotte. I think we need another Sherman to do some urban renewal. But Henry Grady said that what we're after is a new South under Old South.
And he said that
conditions. He said that in the 1880s.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. You have people like Edward Pollard, for example, a writer in the years following, immediately following the Civil War, who talked about a new South. What they meant was a South without slavery, but not necessarily a South without white supremacy.
And that leads us to this question. You tried to set up a bicentennial commission, Bertram, to commemorate Jefferson Davis's 200th birthday in 2008. No one would take you up on the idea, not even in Mississippi, of all places. Is that because of the connection of the Civil War to slavery, or were there other factors at work?
You know, we struggled with that a lot, and I think one of the things that we learned rapidly is that, again, that one sentence in the history book is what's tied to Jefferson Davis. And if you only have that one sentence, it becomes significant and at the same time insignificant. And as we went forward, we understood that as I conversed with people saying we need to talk about the entire 81 years of his life in a celebration. People began to understand it, but it was way too late. So that was 2008. Now we're at 2015, and we're just now seeing greater interest in America about Jefferson Davis because of what it is I've tried to do.
Let's talk about what he did before he became the president of the Confederacy. You were very quick to point out that he served in the U.S. Army in the Mexican War and survived, which is an accomplishment. He served in the United States House of Representatives. He served in the United States Senate. He was the U.S. Secretary of War under Franklin Pierce. 53 years he lived before he became the president of the Confederacy. And he accomplished more than most people did in that time, in any time. Why do people want to erase all of that?
To the victor go the spoils. That's all I can – I mean, we reflect on that, and people say, why don't I know that? Well, even if you go to the capital of the United States of America today, and the first thing you see when you walk into the visitor center is a Statue of Freedom. You read about six lines down, and it's Jefferson Davis, who is completely responsible for that statue on top of the dome. America doesn't know that, and they don't know who Jefferson Davis is. And he's sprinkled throughout that exhibit of the Capitol one of his greatest accomplishments.
Wow.
But he's to the victor go the spoils, so it's kind of been buried underneath.
Well, given his contributions and the work that he did for this country prior to his becoming president of the Confederacy, how difficult was it for him to turn his back on all of the things that he had accomplished for the United States and in the United States to become the president of the Confederacy? Did he write about that in his memoirs?
Well, what he did say is this, is that first of all, he didn't want to leave. There's no question about it, and I think the professor said the same thing. His ending speech was, you know, to the point of saying, this is the worst thing that could ever happen to us. The second worst thing that could ever happen was when Lincoln actually got elected or whatever. But the third thing is when he was elected president of the Confederate States of America, something he didn't want at all.
Right.
So I don't think there was any premonition about
it. He could have said no.
Jefferson Davis didn't say no to opportunities or responsibilities given to him. That's another one of his facts. He just didn't.
Does that mean he has questionable judgment then?
No, I don't think so. I don't think he ever questioned his judgment at all. I mean, seriously, he would contemplate and understand, but it wasn't something that he would – I mean, here's a gentleman that fought in the Battle of Buena Vista and got wounded in the heel and didn't get off his horse until the battle was won under insurmountable odds and said, stand fast to his troops, which is still held today as a model for the 155th. Became a hero. That's the stoic person that we're talking about.
There was a four-year period between the end of the Franklin Pierce presidency and the beginning of the Lincoln presidency. I think the president in between was James Buchanan. But during the Pierce presidency, Jefferson Davis was Secretary of War. He built the army that defeated him.
He did. Not only did he do that, he did so many things like the Transcontinental Railway, he was responsible for that. And when we went to the Lincoln Museum, they showed us one of the books that was in Lincoln's desk. Do you know which book it was?
No.
Transcontinental Railway Surveys. And what did Lincoln focus on during the war? The rail centers. He learned from Davis what was important that he needed to control.
He sowed the seeds of his own defeat unbeknownst to himself.
And he knew that going in, and
well,
I think
he also knew because he built the army. He knew what he was going to be up against. He knew what that army was capable of. He knew the inner machinations of how it worked, even though Edward Stanton was Secretary of War at the time,
or Edwin.
I'm sure things can change in 4 years, and they certainly changed under Lincoln. Lincoln had his own struggles with his own military, but he knew fundamentally how they thought in the organization, correct?
True, but you also have to understand when he took over presidency, he didn't anticipate there was going to be a war. I mean, he didn't really believe. No, he didn't want it. He didn't aspire to it. They wanted to be quietly become a country. It wasn't something he could see. Now, he could probably see that opportunity was coming.
Yeah.
He just didn't know if it was going to be taken advantage of.
So then did he write about, are there anecdotal stories about what he thought when suddenly he was thrust into this war as the president of the Confederacy, knowing what the Union forces were all about?
He reflects upon what it is that's before him in reference to his challenge about the country. He doesn't reflect so much about the northern position because he really doesn't. He wants to talk more in his anecdotes and all of his papers. He's more worried about how we're going to create this country and how we're going to do it.
Abraham Lincoln had severe problems with the military at the start of the war. He had generals that were working against him, generals that were plotting their own run for president against him. McClellan comes to mind. Until he found Ulysses S. Grant, he was in real trouble. And Jefferson Davis has been criticized because he tried to run the affairs of the Confederate Army because he'd been the Secretary of War in the United States. He knew something about it, evidently. But did he have the same troubles that Lincoln had, or a different set of troubles?
Worse. He was much closer to those incompetent generals that he probably shouldn't have been and faced that fact, Braxton Bragg being one, and then his relationship with Joe Johnson was never anything other than adversary. So there was a lot of adversarial relationships in that, and there's a lot of friendships that probably detracted from the overall success of the war.
I don't recall ever, when I was a kid, I was kind of a Civil War buff. I don't recall ever reading about Jefferson Davis's troubles, only about Lincoln's struggles with his military. Is that because Lincoln won?
That probably is true, but Jefferson Davis, as Bertram indicated, had a great deal of trouble. For example, when General Sherman was moving toward Atlanta, Joseph Johnston was the Confederate general that he was confronting, and Johnston wanted to preserve his army. So Sherman would not make an attack on his center until Kenesaw Mountain. And when he did, Joseph Johnston really tore his army up, and Sherman would never make that mistake again. But I think Jefferson Davis got impatient with Johnston's unwillingness to go out and fight. So he replaced Johnston with John Bell Hood, General Hood. And it's said of Hood that he had a heart of lion and a head of wood. And the Atlanta campaign proved that. And General Sherman had a relatively easy time moving to Atlanta once that change was made.
You have said that when you became the head, the president, I guess, of the Davis Family Association, that it changed your life.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
I realized at that point in time the family, which, you know, I consider my family, had decided that they needed leadership. Very, very similar probably to the telegram that Davis got, or to his West Point appointment is more what I think. And it changed the way I needed to look at my ancestor. I felt like I needed to know what he was about. So when I talk about Davis and I talk about places and whatever, that's why I'm here. I've never been to Charlotte. But now I can talk about Charlotte from a first person. Mm. Been here, understand what he went through. So it changed my life in reference to purpose, and also because I have the name. I have lots of cousins. I'm A, not the. But because I was given that opportunity with the name, I felt like I needed to do exactly what they asked me to do.
You say something that a lot of people might be surprised about or would take exception to, but I want you to explain it. You say that your great-great-grandfather, Jefferson Davis, was an equal to Lincoln. How do you make that case?
I don't even think equality is presidential. They were both president of half the country for 4 years. I don't think that we can call it in reference to equality. Davis's previous experience far outweighed Lincoln. No question, he was more prepared to be a president. But at the same time, he was still president of half the country for 4 years. I think that's equal.
David?
Yes, I agree. In terms of the resume, as I said before, there were few that could exceed Jefferson Davis in experience and the quality of that experience. I think the big difference between Davis and Lincoln as leaders, there were two big differences. One, Davis had a much more difficult road to go, and secondly, Lincoln's personality was better suited to that particular task.
Now, I know that Bertram Davis here, Hayes Davis, is on a mission, a personal mission, to repatriate and to reeducate. Okay, and rehabilitate Jefferson Davis's name. But in your view, as an historian, in a country that still has a race problem, in a country that's still fighting a war that ended 150 years ago, what is to be gained by putting Jefferson Davis in a better light?
I always tell my students that history is very complex and that we should not judge people or events by our values in 2015. And I think learning more about Jefferson Davis and what a complex individual he was, I think can give a pretty good appreciation of the complexity and the contingency of history. At the same time, there is no doubt that he led a movement, the Confederate States of America, whose major objective was to preserve the institution of slavery.
Okay. Let me share some things that have come in while we've been talking from people listening to us. Joseph emails, what efforts were made by Jefferson Davis to reconcile the nation after the war?
A great question. I think he understood after the war, after his imprisonment and after his bail, that he needed to move forward. And his message to the southern states was, we are now one, live with one, and let's grow together.
Yeah, he in 1881, wrote a book in which he said the Southerners should reconcile with the North and support the Union.
That's correct.
He'd come full circle.
That's correct.
Jay emails, I'm a first cousin of Mary Boykin Chestnut, and understand the Chestnuts, they were a political family in South Carolina, and understand that the Chestnuts spent a significant amount of time with Jefferson Davis during the war. I'm interested in hearing any anecdotes you may have on that relationship.
Mary Chestnut actually published her notes in her diary, of which I'm going to be ashamed to say that I have not read. So I can't comment directly on that, but I know that they were very close. Maybe, David, can you say?
The Mary's diary does give some really interesting views on the social life and gossip of Richmond, for example. And she notes that of the couple, Verena Howell Davis and Jefferson Davis, Verena was definitely the best part of that duo.
We have a negative comment from Don, who says, of course, families seek to revere their ancestors. It's especially a Southern trait. But listening to this descendant of Jefferson Davis, I think he is just one more of that school of lost cause defenders who have hung around the old Confederacy garlands and wreaths they do not deserve. It was a racist, separatist, and deluded would-be nation, and it lost the war, in capital letters. It would have been better for the future unity of the United States if Davis and his buddies had been punished far more severely.
As I have tried to say to many, I'm not here to represent the Confederate States of America or the creation of the Confederate States of America. I'm here to talk about Jefferson Davis. And we can't compare the two,
right,
as the Confederate States were already created when he was elected president. And so I have difficulty with that.
And Jimmy Mills, I find this conversation interesting and of historical value. I agree with your guest. History is important to know. However, as a Northerner, I've been completely baffled by the religious-like interest in it in the South's war of Northern aggression. I was shocked to learn of this term after moving here. It is history, not a living, breathing entity. Do Southerners revere their relatives who fought in World War I, World War II, Korea? Is there a life-size statue in every little town to these veterans? No. If the South had spent the last 150 years moving forward instead of glorifying and licking their wounds, it would be a lot farther ahead in so many ways. After fleeing Richmond to Charlotte, captured by the Union forces in Georgia, imprisoned for treason for 2 years in Fort Monroe, Virginia, and he was released. His bail, Jefferson Davis's bail, was partially paid for by Horace Greeley, an abolitionist. We will leave it at that. Bertram Hayes Davis, the great-great-grandson of Jefferson Davis, David Goldfield, professor of history at UNC Charlotte. Thanks for the hour.